rise. The Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Morning, please be seated. We are here for oral argument in our case number CV24-0795, Giacone v. Youngtown. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for reserving a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning, and with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. This case is about a very specific and narrow issue, and that is whether or not an implied actual...
Counsel, did you want to identify yourself and the client you represent?
Sorry.
You're not the first one to do that.
Your Honor, I represent Youngtown Health Incorporated, doing business as Sunview Respiratory and Rehabilitation Center, Bandera Healthcare LLC, and Ensign Group Incorporated. Those are the defendant's appellants. So as I was saying, Your Honors, this case is about a very specific and narrow issue, implied actual authority. And that was what we believe we put on sufficient evidence at the evidentiary hearing of August 23rd, 2024, regarding the implied actual authority relationship between Cheryl Weir, the decedent, and her daughter, Maritska Giacone, who went by Missy.
So you you paired a motion to compel arbitration with a motion to dismiss, right?
Correct.
And you start your statement of the case on page one, sort of explaining why Ensign Group, and I think another one of your clients, should not have been named as party defendants. Do you agree that issue is not in front of us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Just wanted to check.
So as we know from the two cases I think that were cited most frequently in the briefing, Heafy versus Willow Canyon Healthcare and Ruesca versus Kindred, the Supreme Court in Arizona has established that the existence of an agency relationship may be and frequently is implied from the words and conduct of the parties and the specific circumstances of the particular case. And if it appears that there was at least an implied intention to create it, the agency relation may be held to exist notwithstanding whether or not the parties understood it to be an agency. So what we have here is a unique situation in that in Heafy we were looking at a spousal relationship of a spouse who was acting on behalf of her incapacitated husband, and a similar situation in Ruizga. But here, what we're talking about is unique in that there's no dispute in the case that the principal here, Ms. Weir, was alert-oriented and cognitively intact during all relevant time periods related to this issue. And so instead of having to try and infer what her intent was, we can look to the course of conduct that she had over the course of the 9 days between July 6, 2021 and July 15, 2021, and take the totality of that evidence, and the cumulative effect of that is that she intended and manifested her intent in a variety of ways that her daughter, Missy, act as her agent for purposes of the admission documents that related to the admission to Sunview.
You're not arguing apparent authority, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. We're limiting it, and I tried to make...
There was some discussion in the briefs about apparent authority, so that it confused me because I thought we were implied actual authority.
That's correct, Your Honor. Implied actual, and I tried to narrow that for the trial judge, and I tried to be clear about what theories we were not asserting, right, so that it was crystallized for his decision.
So for implied actual authority, we need, I guess, implied statements or conduct between the mother and the daughter, right?
Correct. And so what we have primarily in terms of direct evidence that was presented at the hearing regarding Cheryl Weir's manifestations of her intent was, first and foremost, her own handwriting across the front of the admission packet, paperwork packet, stating that she wanted her daughter Missy to read the packet first. So, and there's no dispute about it being her handwriting.
How do we know that that note was to the daughter? Wouldn't it have to be to the daughter for that to somehow impart implied actual authority? If she was making that note to the hospital, I'm not sure it would count.
So I believe it was to both. So what we had was testimony from another daughter during the course of the evidentiary hearing. Her name was Hanukkah White. And what she testified to and what we established from visitor logs was that Hanukkah White came in to visit her mother on the morning of July 9, 2021 at 10:15 a.m. And she said by that time the note had already been written across the front of the packet. And during the course of that visit, she and her mother had a series of communications, although albeit not verbal, because Cheryl Weir could not speak.
That's Hanukkah, not Missy, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So Hanukkah and her mother had written communications back and forth about that it should be Missy to complete this packet, because Hanukkah started to fill it out in terms of demographic information on the forms. She quickly realized that this was something that Missy should be signing, and Cheryl agreed with her.
A note that says, I want Missy to read this, doesn't mean that I'm conferring authority on Missy to act, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That's why we're arguing that we have to look at the totality of everything that happened during this 9-day period. So on July 6th, we have text messages that were produced in which Cheryl Weir is asking Missy to come to the facility and sign documents. That's number one. We have the handwritten note across the front of the packet, which I just mentioned, on at least on July 9th, based on Hanukkah's testimony. And then we also have Hanukkah's testimony that in response to Cheryl expressing to her that she wanted Missy to sign it, Hanukkah then proceeds with efforts to get a hold of Missy to get her to come to the facility to sign the paperwork. And the facility itself started calling and contacting Missy, according to her own testimony, asking her to come to the facility to fill out the paperwork. So that's what's happening between July 9th and July 15th. So we know that Missy comes in on July 15th, and that she's handed the paperwork by an employee of Sunview, and that she fills it out with the employee present with her near the nurse's station she described. And she testified that she didn't ask any questions about anything she was signing. She said she reviewed it but didn't read it in great detail. And that was why she was there. She was there to sign the paperwork based upon her mother's request that she do so. So those are direct evidence. We also have a series of circumstantial.
How specific does the authority have to be with respect to signing an arbitration agreement versus signing a packet of documents?
Well, I think because Cheryl herself had an opportunity to review what was being presented, and that's when she wrote to across the front, I want Missy to read this first. Cheryl was aware that this document contained a variety of consents and agreements, including financial, insurance-related documents, the arbitration agreement, consents to treat, consents for certain medications.
How do we know that she was aware of what the documents were in the packet? Was there testimony or evidence about that?
So the facility representative who testified that it would have been presented to her, and then we know from Hanukkah's testimony that the note already existed across the front by the 9th. So
okay, but we don't have testimony that, for example, she at least leafed through the entire packet of documents before writing the note, do we?
True, Your Honor. But by the nature of implied actual, it always tends to be these oftentimes, you know, circumstantial pieces of evidence that lead us to the conclusion that the principal intended to create this relationship. And I wanted to mention some of these.
I guess, does the implied actual authority have to be authority to just sign things on my behalf? Or more specific, it has to be implied actual authority to sign arbitration agreements or this particular arbitration agreement?
So I think it is an implied actual authority to sign documents related to the admission. And I think based upon the Canyon State Canners Supreme Court opinion that I was reading off of that was quoted in Ruesga, that it doesn't really matter if the understanding of the parties is ultimately correct as to the scope of the agency. So the circumstantial pieces of evidence that came out during the hearing included the following. Otis, who was Ms. Weir's husband, was never asked to sign this packet of information, despite the fact that he testified he was there every day. Cheryl herself did not sign it, even though it's undisputed that she had the cognitive ability to do so, and that she had always made her own decisions prior to this. And then Honecker's testimony was that she stopped filling out the demographic part of the forms when she realized that it was more than just demographic information that would need to be signed here, and that's when she had her communication with her mother about who should sign. Then the fact that the facility started to call Missy, as Maritska testified to in the hearing, is circumstantial evidence that the facility was relying on Cheryl's representation to them that Missy should be the person to sign these documents. Also, Your Honors, the fact that the paperwork...
Is the facility's reliance relevant to your claim for implied actual authority?
I don't think it hinges on it, but I think it's circumstantial evidence that the agency relation existed, both from the perspective of the principal's intent as well as the fact that it was carried out by the agent, in this case, the daughter. The fact that the paperwork was not ultimately signed for 9 days after the admission is evidence that they were waiting for the right person to sign according to what the principal's wishes were. And the family, according to the testimony...
What is our standard of review? The question of whether there is actual implied authority is, I think that's a legal question, right?
Correct.
But then how does that interact with the underlying facts that go into that inquiry? If the court looks at, for example, the text message between mother and daughter and says, I think it's vague, isn't that a factual finding that we defer to?
True, Your Honor, but I think that, again, the totality of all the evidence we presented over the course of this relevant 9-day period between admission and signing, that it required the trial court to consider all of it and not just isolate one thing and say, I don't necessarily think that is what you think it is. The family in this case testified that they all understood that Cheryl was choosing Maritska as her decision maker, and that's why Maritska had already been chosen previously to handle the house, real property issues, and that they were trying to get her in place for a healthcare power of attorney, but were unable to get that signed in time. Also, the fact that Maritska showed up to Sunview on the 15th in response to the facility calling her and asking her to come in is circumstantial evidence that she understood what her job was.
And she signed the documents.
And
right?
She signed the documents.
That's pretty good evidence for you.
And I've honestly, Your Honor, I've never seen a case like this where we have a person that cannot speak physically, but who's competent, and it's not being disputed with the competency issue, and she writes across the front in the way that this decedent principal did, because I feel like that's fairly clear evidence of her intent that she wanted her daughter to be the person to make this decision. And it makes sense that she would, given that her daughter has been working in the healthcare business for Banner for 13 years up to that point. So if you had a child who had some specialized knowledge and experience, it would make sense that you would defer to them on an issue like this, like admission-related documents.
Okay, let's say there's an expertise, and she's not intending to designate any agent. She just wants information from somebody who might be in this space. isn't that another logical explanation here, that she wants to talk to the subject matter expert before she makes her own decision?
And I would agree with you if all we had was the note across the front about reading first. But what we had at the hearing that was very compelling evidence was Hanukkah's testimony about her, not her conversation verbally, but her communications with her mother on the 9th, and her mother expressing to her, I want Missy to be the one to sign this. And that's what prompted Hanukkah to reach out to Missy and say, Mom wants you to come in and sign the documents. She wants you to be that person. So that's what ultimately led to Missy coming in on the 15th. And with 5 minutes remaining, I would reserve my balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Abney.
Sorry, my notes are more. I try to put my notes on one page, but sometimes the page gets filled up, and I'm not quite sure what I wrote. May it please the court, my name is David Abney. I am here with Tammy Wilborn. We're representing the plaintiffs' appellees for a change. As I was driving into oral argument today, I was contemplating Caitlin Carr, because I often do, not in a creepy way, but I wish she were a lawyer here, my co-counsel. I know we'd win this.
The basketball player?
Pardon me?
The basketball player?
Yes.
Okay.
Because if she were here, my co-counsel, I know we'd win by 40 points. I just need to win by 1 point, and I hope the court will indulge us and help us with that victory. The evidence is viewed under the clearly erroneous standard as far as determinations of fact and factual statements and all that. That's clearly erroneous. The overall determination about agency would be an issue of law for the court to determine de novo. But you have before you...
It's sometimes hard in these mixed questions of law and fact issues to determine which things go in which box.
Yes.
So I guess things like how clear or not the text message is...
Yes.
That goes into the fact box?
Yes. Well, it looked like to me they were relying on three things. One, where there was a series of text messages to Giacone, and the text messages were, we can't find Otis. You need to come in here and sign some things. And eventually they found Otis, so that particular flap went away. And then the next thing is the entry, I want Missy to read first, that Judge Kiley mentioned. And really all that means is I've got a daughter, she's fairly smart, I want her to read this stuff. And then after that, one would presume there'd be some sort of consultation if they had time to do that. It doesn't mean I want her to sign the package or that I want her to sign the arbitration agreement in particular, which seems to me the case
right,
law...
Yeah. You heard me ask questions of counsel about how specific the authority has to be. What is your view on that?
I believe it has to be specific. The court,
to this agreement,
yeah, the
this
court's,
arbitration agreement.
The court split. They seem to say, okay, you've got these admission documents, that's one thing. But when there's an arbitration agreement, that's a separate thing to look at. Is there separate authority for this arbitration agreement? Because it's so important. I mean, it really does away with your federal and state constitutional right to a trial, especially in a state where that defends the rights of tort litigants so strongly in the Constitution. This is something to take very seriously and to regard as a separate issue.
Do you have a case that says that it has to be specific to the arbitration agreement?
I cited them in the answering brief, and I can't bring them to mind, but it's, there is a separation there, that the arbitration agreement is regarded as a separate thing as far as inclination and authority.
You agree we're dealing with actual implied authority here?
That's out the window.
Not apparent?
No, everything's gone except for this actual...
Right.
Actual.
Your brief went into apparent authority for a few pages, and I was...
Oh, that was confusion on my part.
It's confusion on mine, too.
Yes, and I'm sorry about that. This is an implied actual authority case. They threw everything else out the window, and I thought that they were going to make, at some point, a hay out of the powers of attorney. But on page 4 of the opening brief, they said that those powers of attorney don't matter. They have nothing to do with this. So the fact
right,
that she
at
had
at least one POA checks the real property box, but
right.
Then I think it checks a box that's broader than that.
Well, fortunately, under opening brief page 4, that doesn't matter.
Right.
They're out, both of them. One was, I think one was really focused on real estate, and the other is just general health care power of attorney. But they agreed in the opening brief, of course they agreed during the proceedings as well, that those things would not count. So we're here on actual, implied actual authority, but you, and you have to make some sort of...
Maybe that POA plays some role in implied actual authority?
You know, if I were on their side...
It's mutually exclusive. A piece of evidence either has to go to express or it has to go to implied actual. It can't go to both.
If I were on their side, I would try to make some hay out of that to answer. But they didn't. They stopped making hay. They specifically said, this is, has nothing to do with it. Okay, so they're bound by that. But even if you try to do something with it, the healthcare power of attorney is not specific to arbitration matters. It really is focusing on healthcare. And, you know, arbitration is different. It's, you know, the fact that they wrecked her health and contributed to her death and all that stuff. That's bad. But that's not really dealing with the power of attorney.
Yeah, the durable, I think, focuses on medical care. Yeah. But then there was the other one that I think one could argue was broader than real property even.
One could, but I would not do that. Counsel, they didn't do
so
it.
So rather than address each of the three pieces of evidence, what about your colleague's argument that it's a totality analysis here, and if you're just sort of assessing each piece individually and questioning it, that's not their argument. Their argument is the totality of the three pieces.
If you put all this stuff in the sausage machine, you're still not going to get a hot dog. There's not enough there, even if you consider the totality of everything that happened, to say that this daughter had the implied actual authority to sign such an important document on behalf of the mother. And the mother, you could see there's concern, I would, from the mother's part, she wants Missy to read this stuff, to take a look at it and try to understand it. And
but is it, I mean, if we look at the totality, what's our standard of review? Are we looking for reasonable evidence to support the court's interpretation of these communications or something else?
I think it's a slightly different perspective. You're looking at the court's evaluation of all the facts and say, well, is it clearly erroneous, the court's conclusion here, factual conclusion, about the authority, about these facts, whether they constitute enough to go forward on this and prove this up, and I don't think you get there. And if you back up and say, we're going to look at this de novo, are you still not there? There's just not enough fact here to support this implied actual authority. I always want to say actual implied authority. This implied actual authority theory, it just doesn't work. There's not enough.
So the argument on appeal that there is evidence to support our position, which is your colleagues, isn't the argument that would win on appeal because we're looking at something different here. We're looking for clear error and we have some deference. Is that?
You're looking for clear error. That's the problem for their side. And so
if the evidence is split and there's evidence on both sides here, what do we do?
Well, it's not so much there's evidence on both sides. Well,
let's assume there is.
All right. Assuming there's evidence on both sides, it's ambiguous. And the trial court has to cut through the ambiguity. Assuming there's not evidence for both sides, the evidence that they're proposing, that they're relying on so heavily, is ambiguous. You just can't grab a hold of it and say, yes, here we've got clear, solid proof that there was a delegation, an implied actual authority. Plus, you've got to get Sunview involved in all this. I mean, it's not enough that maybe the mom says to one daughter, I want something, and maybe she says to another daughter, I want something. It needs to be something that's communicated to Sunview, does it not? I mean, that's the one that you're concerned about.
Well, is it communicated to Sunview or communicated to the purported agent, Jean Coney?
Well, sort of. Could you restate the question, please?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Sunview, I probably want to make sure that the person signing the agreement has authority, so I probably would ask questions. But I'm not sure the legal question of whether one party has given implied actual authority to another turns on what Sunview knew.
It would turn on what would be apparent to Sunview. You mean you're making
apparent. Now you're back in apparent authority again, like you were in your brief.
Well, that's where we get into the implied actual authority. there must be some sort of implication or inference that Sunview is taking up that there is actual authority here.
Isn't the implication between the mother and the daughter, I want you to act as my agent, rather than what would be apparent to the institution?
Well, if the mom said, I want you to act as my parent, as my agent, we've got express authority.
I mean, if Sunview had went and asked Missy, do you have authority to sign the arbitration agreement, and Missy had said yes, then I think we'd be in apparent authority land.
Probably, but it wouldn't help.
Which?
Because you cannot build agency based upon what the agent says to a third party. There has to be independent proof apart from what the agent says. So even if Missy runs around this facility and says, I've got an agent, I've got authority, it doesn't matter.
I think apparent authority would be better for your colleague. So in some odd way, I think your client might benefit from not asking that question.
Probably. But we're in a very unique case here. You don't find many defendants that are as candid and frank as this defendant is. We don't have this kind of authority. We don't have that kind of authority.
What do you think they need to show in order to establish their claim of implied actual authority?
They would need to show some statements made to Sunview that induced it to believe there is actual implied authority here.
Isn't that apparent authority?
It's awfully
different?
Close, but the courts carve it out as being something uniquely different. And I'm not quite sure how you draw a sharp line here. I know that I don't have to worry about implied actual authority or any of that stuff because they've rejected that as their theory of the case. And they can't, and they won't, I'm sure, try to revive it here. And in fact, they have not tried. In their briefing, they've been very specific about this, that all we're dealing with is the implied actual authority.
So Missy
else.
Walks into the room and tells her mother, I'm going to sign this stack of documents, and does it in front of her. Your theory is that's not implied actual authority because there's still not been some communication to Sunview?
If the Sunview, whatever they call it, the agent for Sunview, the officer for Sunview in charge of all these packets of information and forms, if she was standing right there, yeah, we wouldn't be here because the mom would be saying, I want her to sign for me this, you know. You really have to bend and stretch the facts to find anything where you can say there's authority here on that she had the authority to sign. And there's nothing there to bend or stretch that far.
So just to follow up on Judge Kiley's question, what are the elements of this implied actual authority?
You need an intentional or inadvertent manifestation to a third party, in this case Sunview, that the purported principal, in this case Weir, impliedly wanted a purported agent, in this case Giacone, to perform a certain task on behalf of the purported principal, in this case Weir. I know that's wordy, but I sort of paraphrased it out of one of these old
Which
cases.
Case? What case is that? Hudlow v. American East Life Insurance Company?
That sounds about right. I just don't have it in front of me. But it's the same format that's repeated, usually with fewer words.
But isn't that apparent authority?
No, it's not. It's awfully close.
I mean, your brief says under Arizona law for an agent to have apparent authority, the quote, the principal must make some manifestation to the third party which could reasonably be relied upon to indicate that the agent had the alleged authority, citing Hudlow.
But I think the cases also use that formula for the implied actual authority. There is intentional or inadvertent manifestation. That's part of it. It needs to go to the third party. That's Sunview. That's where their case falls apart because there's no intentional or inadvertent manifestations to the third party that are sufficient to get you over the hump of saying, well, yeah, these documents are being signed by an agent who has implied actual authority.
For one individual to give express actual authority to another, does the third party need to know anything about that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you could sign a document and it just sort of gets shuffled around, and eventually, months and years later, it surfaces. You had the authority from the second that was signed. There could be expressions in private. Well, maybe you have a witness, and the witness says,
so
yeah, this is what happened.
With express actual authority, the third party doesn't need to know, but with implied actual authority, the third party does.
Right. And eventually, of course, in the course of discovery, we're sort of positing that the institution would find out.
So your position is that the Weir's statement to Hanukkah, I want your sister to sign, that has no bearing here. It's not relevant. It doesn't help them because Sunview wasn't present for that conversation. Not because the sister wasn't present, but because Sunview wasn't present.
Yes. And I can add to that, it also doesn't matter because what the mom was saying was ambiguous. She's saying, I want Missy to sign, but sign what? You know, the packet of materials, the forms, you know, something, because the family was upset that she had been in this institution for quite a few days, and the institution was saying, well, we need to get all this straightened out here to make sure we get paid, make sure everything's run properly, make sure you get what you're supposed to be getting in terms of care and all that. And so the pressure was now on, and as Giacconi relates, when she gets around to this signing materials, having them presented to her, it was very hectic that day. And so she wasn't taking time to read things carefully. And in the end, I don't know if she'd read things carefully, if she really understood, because when she testified later, I didn't even know what an arbitration thing was until my lawyer told me. And even then, I didn't understand what it was. So it's an unusual situation in one way. In another way, it's sort of a typical one. You get family members that get involved in these terrible situations. Their loved one is in an institution. They're given a stack of 40 pages worth of forms, and they're supposed to read them over under all this stress and understand it and sign it off without any good explanation from the institution about what everything means and how it all ties together, and that there is general information and package materials that you need to sign for admission purposes and for care purposes, and then there's this special arbitration clause.
Well, that sounds like you're making an unconscionability argument.
Procedural unconscionability, and I don't need to. I don't think my colleague discussed it, so I'll limit my comments to that overstepping, and I apologize for that. If there's no further questions, I feel like I'm in a good place. Probably deluded as usual. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this was not the shotgun approach that we took here. We didn't try to throw every possible conceivable theory of agency out there. We looked at the facts, and we ultimately concluded that there's only one form of agency that fit this scenario, and that was implied actual authority.
What is your position on the third party's role in implied actual authority?
So there was reliance on the part of Sunview. And it came, we know it that it happened because Sunview started calling Missy directly and saying, you need to come in and sign this stuff. Now, why were they calling Missy as opposed to calling Otis or calling Hanukkah?
Is notice to the institution, is that necessary to establish implied actual authority?
I think that that Miss Weir's handwriting on the front was notice to the facility.
So it is? I mean, just answer the question first. So is it or not?
I told the trial judge, I think it involves some level of reliance on the facility that this agency relationship exists.
Okay. And now you can go on and explain why, but I just wanted that answer.
So Missy was the one who was being called, and that there's a very good reason for that. It's because that's who Cheryl wanted to handle this. She had a number of other adult children in the local area. None of them were involved in this. The facility knew that she wanted Missy, and they knew that they had waited 9 days up to that point to get the right person in there that Cheryl would agree she wanted. And so there was a – counsel mentioned urgency. There was urgency.
Is there evidence that Weir communicated to Ms. Giacconi, I want you to handle this for me, whether implied or express?
That Weir communicated with Giacconi?
Yes.
Yes. It came in the form of Cheryl's statement to Hanukkah, which Hanukkah then conveyed to Missy, in combination with the note on the front page of the packet, in combination with prior text messages where Ms. Weir was asking Missy to come to the facility to sign. So I think...
When was the first time your client saw the text messages?
I don't think they did see the text messages, but I don't think they need to see everything. I think they only needed to see enough to know...
Did they see the note?
They did see the note.
And then they saw that she signed the document.
Correct. And they were standing there with her while she, according to Missy, while she reviewed and signed them. So what didn't happen here, Your Honors, is that at any point during this process, what didn't happen is Maritska, in the course of reviewing these documents, said, whoa, whoa, wait a second. This is beyond what I was asked to do here. She never said that. She said she reviewed it and she signed it. She didn't have any questions to ask about anything. So, and she acknowledged in her testimony that there was a 30-day rescissionary period, which she did not exercise. So the trial judge was hung up on the wrong issues. He was hung up on whether or not arbitration is a healthcare decision, which I thought were clear that it isn't. He got hung up on the fact that he didn't believe Sunview followed its own policies in the way that the packet was presented. But we argued at the evidentiary hearing that under the Rizzio case, there is no duty or obligation to go through and explain everything in a standard form contract. And so that goes back to the procedural unconscionability argument that was raised by counsel. And I won't.
Yeah, I don't think we would usually say, take it outside of arbitration, that the counterparty has to sit down and explain all of the terms in plain English to the other side.
But one of the things that the trial judge was very fixated on was whether or not Sunview followed its own policies and practices in the way that
I'm suggesting. I think you're probably right on that.
Yeah.
Because we're supposed to treat arbitration agreements like we would any other contract, right?
Correct. And I believe there's case law in Arizona that states that arbitration is favored. So I think what we have here in conclusion is we have a series of actions, a course of conduct, so to speak, over the course of 9 days, which none of them singularly answers the question definitively, but as a total, cumulatively, it does paint the picture clearly that Cheryl's manifestations of her intent to have her daughter act on as her agent for purposes of these documents, and that was clearly presented at the evidentiary hearing. So the error that we're proposing that was made here was that the evidence presented at the hearing was more than sufficient to establish implied actual authority. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments and your briefing in the case. We will take the matter under advisement and get the parties a decision in due course.